Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Kim Janey, she is the woman of the week here in Boston. Yesterday, she was sworn in as the city's 55th mayor. She is the city's first Black mayor and first woman mayor. Well, she joined us earlier today to talk about her agenda. I want to start by congratulating you on making history in the city of Boston. How many times have you heard a congratulations for that this week?
Oh, countless. And I'm just so grateful. My heart is full with gratitude.
Has that sort of newness of that worn off yet, or are you still feeling it every single time you hear it?
Oh, I still feel it. I am still so grateful. It is still so, so surreal just to think that, you know, here I am sitting here as the first Black mayor and the first woman mayor of our city, something that I wasn't sure I'd ever see. So it's an incredible moment, not just for me personally, but for our city. And I am just super proud of how far we have come as a city.
You know, you just referred to it as an incredible moment. It is. And watching the whirlwind for you over the last few days, it strikes me the stakes are high here. What do you see as your calling to meet this moment that you've been handed? How do you meet that moment?
Well, the first thing that I would say is that my lived experience is very different from the men who came before me. And I will bring that unique perspective to this work. Definitely a focus on racial equity and ensuring that we have an agenda to recover, reopen, and renew our commitment to all Bostonians. Much of that focus in the beginning of the recovery part of the agenda is certainly to ensure that the vaccine is getting out to residents. We have more work to do on that front, especially as it relates to vulnerable populations and communities that are hardest hit, and definitely want to make sure everyone who wants the vaccine has access to the vaccine, has confidence in the vaccine, so that we can safely reopen our businesses to their full capacity, get people back to work, especially the workers who were laid off and displaced at the beginning of the pandemic, and getting our children back into schools with their teachers and their peers.
So sorry to interrupt, but I want to pick up on the vaccine portion. You talked about getting it out to the residents, that there are more steps to take. What's an essential first step to take to be faster and more effective in getting it out to the residents of Boston?
Well, having a good partnership and relationship with our partners at the state, working with Governor Baker and his administration around just distribution, certainly community and local partners here have been very helpful, particularly where there are trusted relationships. One of the things that I am extremely proud of are the mobile vaccination clinics. I will be visiting another one tomorrow. Had the opportunity to visit this same site a few weeks ago at the MLK Towers in Roxbury. And I think meeting residents where they are and not always expecting folks to come to mass vaccination sites is a good strategy. You know, making sure we're lifting up other places where there are trusted relationships, like with our churches and community centers, is really important on this front as well.
I'm struck when I asked you about, you know, what do you need to do to meet this moment? Your answer was very on the ground. It was very practical. Is that revealing? Is the sweet spot for you as you are breaking ground and breaking history in the practical day-to-day? Is that how you see it?
Well, you know, I think it is the practical day-to-day, but also the big vision. You know, everything I think in my life up until now has prepared me for this moment, to meet this moment. I think many folks across our nation have been, you know, electing women of color. We see Black mayors, Black women mayors in cities all across the nation. And I think there is a unique perspective, obviously, that we bring to this work, and a lot of that is the day-to-day. A lot of that is the focus on racial equity and understanding how important this moment is, not just in the city of Boston, but in our country, to do things differently. For me, it is very clear that we cannot go back to the way things used to be. That normal was a wealth gap in Boston that is $250,000. That normal is displacement in terms of people being forced to move out of our city. That normal is an opportunity and achievement gap that persists in our schools. So my focus is to make sure that we are going better. We're not going back. We're going better to a much more equitable city, a more just city, and a more vibrant city. And all of us have a role to play in that.
So I am not trying to sort of trick you with this next question, because I understand that you're not ready. You've been very clear in your interviews over the last few days that you are not ready to discuss a run for mayor for the election in November. I am mindful, however, that the things you just laid out are systemic issues, and that as acting mayor, you serve for the next 9 months. So how do you think about that balance, and how do you think about the steps that you take in your first 50 days, your first 100 days in this period of your mayoralcy, if that's a word, that moves the ball down the field on these big systemic issues like wealth inequality?
Yeah. You're absolutely right. These issues did not appear overnight. These are structural issues, deeply rooted in structural racism and discriminatory practices over a number of years, decades, centuries in the making, and will obviously take more than 9 months to recover from these and make sure that we do get to this more equitable, just city for all of us to enjoy. And so I will be making a decision in the near future around future plans, and will certainly share that with you at the appropriate time.
Let's go back to the three R's that you talked about when you were sworn in, and you mentioned them here too: recovery, reopening, and renewal. I want to plug into renewal. What do you envision in your mind? What do you see in our city when you see renewal?
Well, one, I want to just acknowledge that there is a good foundation already here in our city in terms of the things that we need in place. I want us to renew our commitment to the residents of Boston around housing and climate change, around public transit, around improving our schools, addressing police reform in our city. But part of this agenda for renewing also means that we create space not only to bring people in, new voices in, people who may have felt left out of power in the past, that we also create space for joy, what I've been calling a joy agenda. This past year has been so incredibly difficult for all of us. COVID-19 has impacted everyone. And so we have to make sure that we are coming back together as we reopen and recover from this pandemic, that we reconnect with each other, that we rebuild with each other in terms of relationships, and that we take time to celebrate the things that make Boston so wonderful. You know, this is a great world-class city. We're a championship city. There is a lot to be proud of in our city, and we need to ensure that the prosperity that is in Boston is shared, and that we are doing everything that we can to just rebuild that faith when it comes to shared prosperity in Boston and the commitment that people have for our city. And I'm encouraged because so many people care about our city, you know, and it's, you know, our business leaders, it's our faith leaders, it's our community leaders, it's everyday residents, it's the wonderful employees who make this city strong. And so I'm encouraged by the work that is already underway. But I want to make sure that we are intentional about creating this space to reconnect with each other so that we can have that more vibrant city And it goes beyond what many people think when we think about our city and downtown and all of the places here in the center of our city. It has to spread out through our neighborhoods. Hmm. You know, the neighborhoods are what make Boston so special, certainly to me.
I want to take you back to a particular moment earlier this week. Before you were even sworn in, you went to the Edwards Middle School in Charlestown.
Yeah.
You've
yeah.
talked openly about being a part of busing in the early 70s. You've talked openly about a different lived experience than the white male mayors that came before you. Take us to the moment when you put your foot over the threshold of the door of the Edwards Middle School as mayor, and what went through your mind?
Wow, it was just an incredible day, my first full day as mayor. And the very first thing that I did as mayor, I obviously wanted to visit a school. Given my background, you know, I come from a family of educators. I spent much of my career in education advocacy, so I knew I wanted to visit a school. But I thought it was particularly important to visit the Edwards because, you know, my experience there was very painful and traumatic. What all of the students who lived through that era in our city's history, and they were very dark days. And so to be able to go back as mayor and to visit that school and to see our young people in the classroom engaged in the learning, I visited one classroom in particular where they were learning about desegregation. And then to be able to share with them my story, and then to stand there as the first Black mayor for our city and the first woman mayor for our city was just really a powerful moment, I think, for the young people in the classroom. And so just incredible, and I think really a symbol of how far we have come as a city. And so it was particularly special because of that. It was a signal of the progress that we have made as a city. That being said, we obviously have a lot more work to do in Boston, and I'm excited to do that work in partnership, whether it be our superintendent around our schools, working with the police department, working with business leaders or key stakeholders. I'm excited to do this work in partnership with the folks who love Boston as much as I do.
You are in a moment of goodwill and recognition. What is the most important obstacle to get out of your way in the city towards progress? Or what is one thing that a part of the Boston community needs to do to make it possible to carry your vision forward?
Well, I hope that people are willing to not only have the tough conversations when it comes to some of these structural issues and challenges in our city, but be willing to do the work. And I'm encouraged that in fact, will happen. There is certainly a lot of folks who care deeply about Boston who are working hard every single day, not just the employees that work for the city, but key stakeholders in our community, and I want to make sure that there is room at the table for everyone who wants to do this work.
Boston Mayor Kim Janey on what's really day three. Thank you for joining us. I hope you'll come back for regular conversations with us. I appreciate
Absolutely.
Speaking with you.
Absolutely. I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you so much.
The Boston Bruins return to action tonight in the TD Garden, and for the first time in more than a year, there will be fans in the stands. Meanwhile, there was a lot of buzz around Danny Ainge and the Boston Celtics possibly making a move at the trade deadline, which just passed about 20 minutes ago. So listen,
womp,
that really
womp.
Matters. Not happy with that. So I want folks to know that trade deadline matters if we want to, Chris, as you and I have talked about, fall in love with and get behind the Celtics this spring. So obviously we got Chris Siderick here to check the score. Hey there, Chris.
Hey, Tiziana.
So do you want to start Bruins or do you want to start Celtics? There's a lot here.
Yeah, there is a lot here. I'm wearing the black and gold, so let's start with the Bees. This has been a two-year crusade now, as many folks will remember, of me trying to bring you on board the Bruins fan bandwagon here. And I've decided it's time to recruit some help, right? So we're going to bring WVUR's Morning Edition senior news writer, Sarah Rose Brenner, who will be in the Garden tonight for the Bees game. Hey, Sarah Rose.
guys. How are you?
Doing all right.
Sarah Rose. All right, you two take it away because you know the Bruins like I don't yet, although this is bringing in a ringer, Chris. Yeah, you're bringing in a ringer.
Don't worry. That's right. So, Sarah Rose, set the stage for us a little bit before we get into the team. This is obviously, it's been more than a year since fans have been in the Garden. What is that going to look like tonight? What is the Garden putting in place here?
Well, honestly, it might look a little sparse. It's 12% capacity for fans. It's about 2,200 people, and they're going to be very spread out. You know, I talked to Amy Latima, the Garden president, and she said that it's just unbelievable to see all of the space around the groups of people. So the groups, you can only sit with no more than three people. So groups of four, and they all have 6 feet around them, and you can't gather in the concourses. And then they have the other, you know, pandemic safety measures that we've seen, you know, we've become accustomed to. Like, fans are being asked to wear face masks, and ushers actually have yellow cards. So if they see a fan not wearing a mask, they're going to give them a yellow card. And yes, it is like
that
soccer.
Is soccer. What are we doing?
Yes,
here?
It's like soccer. So if you get two yellow cards, you might get kicked out of the Garden.
Do you
so
get penalty shots? That's the question, right?
Nope, it's just straight out, and then you're suspended for a game. I'm kidding. They all might right. let you back in.
So this is a team that has had a bit of a bumpy week due to COVID. Where are we at in terms of players back? Is everybody back? Do we still have a couple on the COVID list?
Oh, yes. There are a couple on the COVID list. There were five total players in the protocol. They were all forwards. Three are coming back: David Pastrnak, David Krejci, and Craig Smith. They'll all be on the ice. But Jake DeBrusque and Sean Corrali are still out. And then also the Bruins have a fair number of injuries, and most of the injured players are not coming back, like Brandon Carlo, who is skating, but he's been out since March 5th because of a really dirty hit in the Capitals game.
Yeah, so they have struggled with injuries, especially defensively. I'm hearing Tuukka Rask could be back in net tonight. Are you hearing that, and how big a return would that be?
Yes, Tuukka Rask is expected to start for the first time since, you know, early March. He's back, and the fans are back, and it just feels like kismet that they're both coming back at the same time. You know, he's been out with an undisclosed injury, and he's only one win shy of his 300th career win. So how cool would it be if he got that milestone tonight?
There we go. So there's going to be obviously a ton of energy in the building tonight. I'm sure fans are itching to get back into the building and cheer this team on. I'm curious what you make of this team. Tiziana and I have talked about the fact that they've struggled to score at times. Do you think they can be contenders?
Okay, can I love them?
yeah, we'll get you there, TD. Don't worry.
Yeah, you know, anyone can love this team. I mean, I think they have arguably the best first line in hockey, so I'm never going to count that team out. They also have a great goalie tandem with Rask and Yaro Halak, so you can't really, I mean, they're going to be contenders. Look, they're fourth in the East right now. They're only 10 points out of first place, and they've played fewer games, like up to four fewer games than other teams in that group. So they definitely have a chance. And if you're counting the Bruins out, you're insane.
All right. So I want to ask the two of you before we let you go, Sarah Rose, just put it in perspective, especially for people who maybe have never been to a Bruins game. How big of a deal is it to have fans in the stands tonight?
Oh, it is massive. The energy in the Garden, it's like nothing I've ever been around. It's just like it buzzes, and the players, they notice it on the ice, you know, like not having fans has really negatively impacted the game. So they're also really looking forward to this.
Yeah, I mean, that place gets so loud, especially for Bruins fans. And I have no doubt, even though there's only 12% capacity in there, the players are going to hear them. And this is a team I think that really could use the boost. Over the last 12, they're 5-5-2. And it really has felt like they've just kind of been missing a little bit of that heart, a little bit of that enthusiasm over the last few weeks. Obviously, the week off doesn't help that either. So hopefully fans in the building can give them a little bit of a jolt and help them make this run down the stretch.
Well, WBUR Sarah Rose Brenner, we're going to let you go because you got to head down there. Have a great time tonight.
Yes.
Thanks for joining us.
Be nice and loud for us. Woo.
Thanks.
There you go. So, Chris, now we got to move to the Celtics. And you've said they've been lacking heart all year. The trade deadline was today at 3 p.m. We were kind of waiting all day to see what was going to happen, what we were even going to be talking about here on the show. So here's my little drum roll on my desk at home. What happened?
I'm going to reiterate, womp, womp. Look, all right, so they did make a deal. I have to put this in perspective a little bit. Danny Ainge, the GM with the Celtics, hasn't made a trade deadline deal since 2015. It's been 6 years since they've made a move in season like this to try to help give that team just a little bit of extra to put them over the edge. They did trade 2 second-round picks for Evan Fournier. They had been targeting Aaron Gordon. That deal ended up falling through. Aaron Gordon's going to Denver. They were looking for kind of a big man who could shoot and play defense. Evan Fournier is a guard who can score.
Yeah, so, I don't know who this guy is, right? Yeah. I'm not a huge basketball fan. So what does it mean to take this guy?
So he is a scorer. He can put up about 20 points a game, which is not nothing, but it also doesn't really address what this team needs. Right now, this team, we've talked about the culture, right? That they aren't able to close games.
Yeah.
That they, you know, go all the way back to last summer when they almost lost to Toronto after being ahead in that series and then ended up getting knocked out by Miami. They really continue to get themselves into big holes, just like they did last night against the Milwaukee Bucks.
And the Bucks are a good team, right? They're one of the best.
They are, but the Celtics should also be one of the best. They have two of the best young players in the league, and they end up going down 25 points to the Bucks. And it looked like it was just this lack of energy and passion and heart on the floor that kind of digs this hole. And then they claw their way back. They do all this work. They get to within two, and they had a shot to win it at the buzzer.
Giannis, no timeouts. Smart will again inbound set from this side. Finds Tice for a three and the win. No good. And the Bucks hang on, almost blowing a 25-point lead. Tice got a great look. He knew it, but he couldn't hit it.
Oof. Oh, you know, we need things to be excited and happy about as we're trying to crawl our way out of the pandemic. That sounds like it hurt.
Yeah, and you could hear it in the players after the game. Tice, after he missed that shot, really just leans his head back and screams to the heavens in frustration. I got to play you a little bit of Kemba Walker, too, who was phenomenal last night. I really drove this comeback and brought them to within striking distance. But here he is talking about the loss after the game.
Definitely a tough loss, but, I thought we just picked up our effort, our energy. Defensively, when that was the most important thing. And whenever we got stopped, we got a ran. That kind of helped us. We started to get a little bit more momentum. Obviously, we just didn't do that earlier, early on in the game.
I mean, you can hear it in his voice. He just sounds defeated.
All right, so Chris, I want to kind of help spell this out for the listeners. This is a team that got, there's 25 points down. That's bad, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Then they came really close to winning. That's good. But then in the very last second, whiff, right? Or
yeah.
What we used to say about the Bruins, doink, yeah. Right off the
right.
Off the edge.
That, yeah.
So what's it going to take for that saga for this team to change?
And this is why I don't really think they did enough at the deadline, because I think they really have to change the culture and shake up the locker room. Basketball, we always talk about, is so much about chemistry and how these guys work with each other and as a unit, right? Not just their individual talents, because they have more than enough talent to be competitive. But if you look at how they finish games especially, there were four shots last night in the last 70 seconds where they're down two and a chance to win this game. None of those four shots were taken by their two best players. So that's a huge problem. You want your best guys shooting with the game on the line. And I have to point out also, Marcus Smart, we talk so much about him being the heart of the team and playing this tough-nosed defense. But he is one of those guys that maybe shoots when he shouldn't. Going into last night's game, I came across a stat that is just really staggering. In fourth quarters and overtimes, he was 11 for his last 48, which is shooting 23%, terrible shooting percentage, and had missed 21 threes in a row in the fourth quarter and overtime, which is, you're just not going to get it done that way. And again, I think the major problem is whatever is going on with this team's chemistry, your best players need to be taking over down the stretch, and it's just not happening. So whatever they have to do to shake it up and kind of wake these guys up, they got to do it, and they got to do it fast.
All right, so I now have a new motivational poster from Chris Sitterick. Quote, you want your best players shooting when the game is on the line.
That's right.
We'll see.
That's why I'm here behind
the
mic, right? Let's go.
That's right. All right, now we have to take on a very sobering subject, because sports penetrates all our lives in some way or another, and it's how we shape our young people often. And we have a disturbing story for the Massachusetts sports world that involves reports of anti-Semitic language from the Duxbury High School football team. Chris, I just want you to give our listeners a rundown of the latest on that story.
Yeah, so if folks have been following this story, the Duxbury High School football team has had their game on Friday night against Hingham canceled, and the freshman and JV games have been canceled this weekend after reports of players using anti-Semitic play calls on the field surfaced this week. So reportedly, they're using phrases like Rabbi, Dreidel, and Auschwitz to call audibles on the field. David Mamaron, the head coach, was fired on Wednesday and also placed on administrative leave as a special education teacher. And actually, Massachusetts State Senator Barry Feingold, who's himself Jewish and also played high school and college football, so kind of understands that culture, has actually reached out to the team to offer to help educate the players on anti-Semitism. And he actually spoke about that work on WBZ TV earlier this week.
When someone says Auschwitz, I don't think these young people understand how harmful and hurtful that is to people that are Jewish.
And I understand that he sees this as an opportunity to create an engagement and learning moment for the kids. We would certainly hope that that happens. And then what happens for the team for the rest of the season?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. We will see. The district has said basically there'll be a decision about the rest of the season at a later date. But I think what makes this story so painful is, you know, high school sports is supposed to be a place where these young student athletes are learning about themselves and their place in the world and how to navigate the world. And we expect coaches to be their mentor and to guide them through that. And when you have a coach setting the absolute wrong kind of tone like this, I think that is what makes it so troubling.
All right. Well, on that note, Radio Boston's Chris Siderick. Chris, thanks for checking the score with us this week.
Always great to be with you.
I'm picturing it. Just picture it. Warm sand under your feet, transparent seas lapping at your ankles, maybe a beachside cabana under the green leaves of a palm tree, some kind of frozen pina colada in hand, or if you're our executive producer, Hitesh, a mango drink, as he reminded me earlier today. It all sounds so good. It is spring break season, and after a year of socially distant pandemic, travel is on the minds of a lot of folks. The numbers bear it out. The Boston Herald reports the Cape vacation rentals are hard to come by for the summer. And this past weekend, more than 100,000 people flew through the region's airports, the highest number of travelers yet this year. But we have to keep in mind, as more people get vaccinated daily, we've still seen cases plateau and then climb for the last 12 days now in a row in this pandemic, with a test positivity rate above 2%. For the last week. So much tension there. With all that in mind, how should we be thinking about traveling? What does safe travel look like? Where can you go? How do you do it safely? What questions do you have about taking to the roads, the rails, the air this spring and summer? We're ready. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's take your questions. So we have two guides, a medical guide and a travel guide, to have this conversation with us. Our medical guide is Dr. Natasha Hochberg, Associate Professor in the Department of Medicine at Boston University School of Medicine and in the Department of Epidemiology at the Boston University School of Public Health. She is also the Program Director for the Infectious Disease Fellowship Program, and here's the important one also, co-director of the Travel Clinic and an infectious disease physician at Boston Medical Center. Lots of expertise there. Also joining us is Christopher Muther, who is the travel writer and the columnist for the Boston Globe. I want to welcome you both. Dr. Hochberg, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Christopher, welcome.
Thanks so much. Pleasure to be here.
So excited to learn from both of you. Excited to take listener calls on this. Christopher, I'm going to start with you. We are seeing more air travel across the nation. We just heard some numbers for here in New England. Are more people traveling now? How many more? And where are they going?
Well, first I have to say, I'm still picturing myself with a tropical drink after your introduction.
Yeah. So right?
Having a hard time focusing right now on the question.
I hear you.
But yes, people are traveling far more than they were. I mean, obviously last year at this time and all through the spring and summer of last year, the TSA is now screening pretty regularly more than a million travelers a day, which, you know, a few months ago would be unheard of. And as you mentioned, it is spring break. And so you have people who are going to Florida, and families going there, and then you have people who are just frustrated. I feel like we all are, and are hopping on a plane and going to see family members. They're going to amusement parks, which is, you know, is surprising to me. But yeah, it's people are taking to the road. There's most of the travel has been domestic, and Dr. Hochberg may have thoughts on this as well, but most of it has been domestic and to the Caribbean, which are kind of the easiest places that U.S. citizens can travel to right now.
So listeners, are you making travel plans? Like, are you booking something right now? Are you thinking about it? Is it for spring or summer? Are you waiting until you're vaccinated? Do you have questions about that? Where are you going and what steps are you taking that you normally wouldn't take to be safe? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, Dr. Hochberg, I'm going to turn to you. I am mindful that when we have this kind of conversation, it's tricky because we want to deal with the reality of where people are. We also want to deal with our public health realities. We are in stage four of the state's reopening. The state's travel form and lower risk state's map is no longer in effect. Is it safe to start traveling?
So that's a great question. And I have to tell you that in the land of public health, I have a boss. And nationally, that's, you know, Rochelle Walensky at the CDC. And so I think when we think about telling people and giving them advice, I want people to first turn to the CDC. And I want you to take a look at what the CDC guidelines are and what Dr. Walensky is saying. And she has clearly laid out that now is unfortunately not the time to travel. And believe me, I too want to get out of here. I think we're all going stir crazy. I have, you know, kids at home. We all want to get to the beach. But Dr. Walensky has made it very clear that cases are high. Now is not the time to travel. It increases your chances of spreading and getting COVID. And that, you know, hopefully we get more information as things go along. But right now, the recommendation is really, unfortunately, not to travel. I know that's not what you wanted to hear, but that's
no, that's all right. I mean, this is why we have you both on, right? We want to look at what people are doing and what the guidance is on what we should be doing. So we do have some calls starting to come in, but Dr. Hochberg, I'm going to stay with you for a second longer. Does that include you're vaccinated, you can't get in your car and drive, let's say, 2 hours over the New Hampshire line to see your grandkids?
So that's two separate questions. And the first question is vaccines and what is the impact of getting vaccinated and how should that change your decision making? And the second is sort of how safe is it to drive and to drive locally? So I'll take the driving first. I think that has much lower risk if you are traveling in a car with people who are within your sort of pod or your family. And if you are traveling to see people that you're going to see outside and or socially distanced from. Or you're wearing a mask and you're staying far away from. I think if you want to be inside with somebody without wearing a mask, that's where the vaccines are particularly important, especially when you're thinking about vulnerable patients and vulnerable people. So if you're potentially going to see somebody who has an underlying comorbidity or they're of older age and potentially at risk for getting really sick with this, you don't want to be potentially exposing that person. And so that's somebody you want to see outside at a distance. But then your second question came to vaccines, and I think that's a great point. So we have to recognize that, you know, fewer than 10% or so of the population is vaccinated at this point. So it's not a large proportion of people, but what does it mean? Well, the reason that the CDC and the NIH are still saying that even if you're vaccinated, they don't want you to travel is because even though we know it prevents severe disease, there's still that potential for you to become infected and transmit it to somebody else. So even though you're protected, you might still transmit it to somebody else. I'll say that there's a lot more data that are coming out about that in terms of, you know, how effective the vaccines are for preventing you from transmitting it to somebody else. But at this point, the CDC still feels like the data are insufficient to tell you that you can safely travel and not transmit it to somebody else.
Thanks for that. So I'm going to go to the phones. I think we've got a call that you'll be able to help with, Christopher. 800-423-8255 is the number to call with your travel-related question. We've got Mike on the line in Hopkinton. Mike, go ahead.
Hi, guys. I drive a limousine part-time, and I wonder when all the commercial travelers are going to start coming back. We are seeing more travel, but it's all private travel. Every single person is going to visit their grandmother, and no companies are going to visit their customers. Is that ever going to change, or what's going to happen?
Thanks for that question, Mike Christopher. So Mike's question about business travel, you know, the bread and butter of the travel industry, at least a part of it. What do we think?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a while, if ever, that we go back to business travel as we knew it, as I like to say, in the before times. We've all become so accustomed to being on Zoom and FaceTime and even the phone and talking to our colleagues around the world in that manner. It's no longer a novelty as it was before. And companies now realize that, you know, look at the bottom line, how much money they're saving. Obviously, not all companies are going to take that approach because in some industries, there's still the feeling that face-to-face meetings are the way to go. But, you know, for instance, I think about the Boston Globe, and we're still not going into our office, let alone traveling anywhere. And that's going to be likely through the fall. So I think, you know, maybe next year, maybe the following year, but I don't see business travel resuming anywhere to 2019 levels anywhere in the near future.
Let's go back to the phones here, 800-423-8255 here on Radio Boston, where we are talking about travel. And we have both a travel expert and a medical expert available for your questions. Robin's on the line in Fort Point. Robin, go ahead.
Hi, I'm going to be traveling to the Cape this summer, like I do every year, actually, and did last year during the pandemic. I'm expecting to still have the same level of COVID protocols in place, regardless of how many people are vaccinated. And I guess, and I didn't know I was supposed to be asking the question, but I, you know, if I see people, I haven't eaten out since I was in the Cape last summer, so I'm highly looking forward to a meal outside. But I think it's crazy to be going into restaurants. So you people, I'm sure you're going to back me up on that.
So let's actually turn to both of our guests. Robin, thanks for your call, Dr. Hochberg. So, I mean, it's interesting as we've started to look forward, we haven't always picked up on the conversation threads that have been here for a while, but restaurants are one of them. Where are we on the safety of restaurant dining right now?
So first of all, I'm so excited for you that you get to go to the Cape, because it does sound like all the houses are filling up. So that sounds like it's going to be a wonderful summer break. I think it's a really tough question, right? We're all getting sick of, you know, sort of cooking for ourselves and not being able to go out to restaurants. I think that the safest thing you can do is to eat outside and to eat sort of distanced from other people. There's still definitely a risk of sort of taking off your mask inside with a group of strangers and potentially becoming infected indoors. So I think your safest bet is to eat outside and to eat distance. If you have to eat inside, you know, hopefully you're vaccinated by that point and your risk is lower.
So I'm going to put out a throw to listeners, and then I'm going to come to you, Christopher. But listeners, as I'm listening to all this, I'm still back on the beach from the beginning of this conversation on my head, and I'm not going there anytime soon. So where, listeners, are you wishing you were going? Where are you longing to travel? We'll be wistful with you. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, Christopher, I am struck by the fact that tourism on the Cape for the summer looks like it's going to be happening. Are you surprised by that? What are the lessons that we take from that? Talk about that a little bit.
I am actually not surprised at all. The Cape last summer, last minute bookings were kind of through the roof at that point. And anecdotally, I've heard this from many people. The agency where my parents book the house that they stay at in Maine, they told my dad that they've never seen anything like it. What's coming up this summer. And, you know, as you've said, we all want to get out. We all want to be doing things. I think the summer in New England, you know, I traveled a bit last summer, and speaking to indoor dining, during the summer, we have an opportunity for outdoor dining, which makes the appeal of going out and traveling so much better for those of us who aren't eating inside yet. And also the idea of doing things outside, you know, at the beach, if it's a beautiful day, going hiking, going biking, all of these things were really embraced last summer, as a, and in addition to RV rentals, which were also through the roof. So I'm not surprised to hear that. And, you know, I'm actually also kind of glad that people are thinking of staying locally, at least those who are reserving, because as Dr. Hochberg said, you know, I feel like wide range traveling is more of an opportunity to spread variants, to generally just spread COVID to different areas, as much as we all really want to travel to other parts of the country and other parts of the world.
So I think we've got a caller question that's related to that. 800-423-8255. We've got Brandon on the line. Brandon, are you in your car?
I am totally in my car right now.
What's your question, Brandon?
Sure. So kind of unique situation, I guess. Kind of hopeful thinking. Me and my wife, 5-year anniversary coming up. We both survived COVID. Our 3 children survived COVID. We're all doing well. Grandparents are in our bubble. If they want to be so nice and allow us to go away for a weekend to celebrate our wedding anniversary, say, you know, beginning of June, is that a good time or just a bad idea in general?
And let me just ask you, Brandon, is, if you don't mind sharing, is anybody vaccinated, the grandparents, for example?
Yes, they both received their first. They'll be fully vaccinated, you know, by beginning of June when we want to go away.
Thanks, Brandon. And by the way, happy anniversary, and I'm glad everyone survived. I'm going to turn over to Dr. Hochberg here to pick this one up.
Sure.
Thanks.
First of all, yeah, congratulations on the anniversary, and I'm so sorry that you were all sick, and I'm glad that everybody is doing okay. So some of this, not to pry into your medical history, but some of this depends a little bit on when you were infected and understanding the durability of the immune response and sort of how long we know you'd be protected for. And so, you know, it depends a little bit on that. And so I think it's something to sort of, you know, without getting into the details with you here, but it's something to sort of talk to your doctor about in terms of when, in fact, you were infected, how early on in the pandemic, and then whether or not you've been vaccinated after having had COVID, because all of that will play a role. But I think it's great that the grandparents are vaccinated. And in general, I think we've seen the CDC recommendations that once those individuals are vaccinated, they can be in the house, you know, with other vaccinated individuals or unvaccinated that are at low risk.
So I want to ask the two of you a question kind of in follow-up to this. So we're hearing from Christopher. Everything is booking up. We're hearing from you, Dr. Hochberg. Yes, but don't go any of those places, please, because your boss at the CDC says it's not time to do that yet. There is a lag in planning travel. So from a medical standpoint first, Dr. Hochberg, and then Christopher from a strategy standpoint second, how far out could people be planning travel now? Is it reasonable to be planning something for August from a public health standpoint, Dr. Hochberg, or are you talking, God forbid, 2022?
I think that we're going to see more guidance actually pretty soon from the CDC. They've been sort of hinting that they'll come out with travel guidance, particularly for people that are vaccinated, because there is some level of assurance that, you know, you are protected from severe disease. And so I think more and more vaccinated people are going to feel safer about traveling. And I think that CDC is going to come around to sort of provide that guidance. And I'm hoping it comes out pretty soon. I can't tell you when exactly that will happen. And so, you know, I think making travel plans for the summer may be reasonable. And let's hope that CDC can support that shortly.
All right. From a strategy standpoint, Christopher, it sounds like one can't wait. Like everything's going to fill up. So are we in a real rock and a hard place now for those who are really trying to follow the public health guidelines? Or can you do some planning for late summer at this stage?
It's such an interesting question, because it feels like it's a constant moving target. You mentioned at the beginning of the segment how numbers had been going down, plateauing, and now going up again. And, you know, back when vaccinations were really starting to pick up in number and we had plateaued and felt like we were going to be going down, I thought, you know, this is it. I can start looking, you know, seriously at summer travel. And now that doesn't necessarily seem to be the case. And Europe seems like it's off the table and will be for a while. So that's the tricky part. And some of it involves, I feel like, what your aversion to risk is. You know, it's a very personal decision how people treat this. You know, there is the CDC guidelines, and there are a lot of people who follow that, and there are a lot of people who don't follow that. And so one of the things that we've been seeing is, yes, places have been booking up ahead of time before summer, but there's also been an extreme amount of last minute travel decisions. If you look at studies over the past few months, you know, normally people plan out travel far in advance. Lately, they're not doing that. They're just kind of jumping on. And I think we'll see a fair amount of that. And so again, the idea of, will we be able to travel this summer? I wish there were an easy answer, a straightforward, yes, not a problem at all, or absolutely not, don't think about it. But it just comes down to so many pieces of the puzzle. Yeah. And for me, I'm waiting for a majority of the pieces to fit, and then I'll really seriously start thinking about it. Also, when I'm vaccinated, I can also start thinking about it a little more. But again, it's a very highly personal decision.
Yeah, I just wanted to echo that. It's funny because if you talk to my colleagues, you'll get some people are absolutely planning their travel and some people are like, nope, if anything, I'll drive to the Cape, and others are getting on airplanes because they're vaccinated. And so I think it's really true. It's somewhat of a, you know, a personal decision how one interprets the data and assesses the risk.
So in our last minute or so, Dr. Hochberg, we weren't able to go to any more calls, but we had several people call with a scenario of vaccinated grandparents who want to see grandkids. Can they go do that? So just once more with feeling, you are vaccinated grandparents. Can you go somewhere far to see your grandkids?
So it depends on your assessment of the risk. The vaccines are quite effective at preventing severe disease. They're not perfect, so you still have some risk. And then it depends on who you're traveling to see. So if there's anybody in the household who you're going to see who's potentially at high risk because of some medical condition, then you're potentially placing them at risk by sort of exposing them. That being said, you are relatively protected against severe disease. And so I think there are steps that one can take if you are going to travel to sort of protect yourself. And obviously wearing masks and sort of distancing from other people to the degree possible, you know, good hand hygiene and not touching your face, leaving your mask on when you're on the airplane. So there are steps that you can take to sort of, you know, ensure sort of the best outcomes.
All right. Thank you for that. And at that, we're going to have to end. That was Dr. Natasha Hochberg, Program Director for the Infectious Disease Fellowship Program and a co-director of the Travel Clinic and an infectious disease physician at Boston Medical Center. Christopher Muther, travel writer and columnist for the Boston Globe. Thanks so much to both of you. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, folks, that is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Tomorrow's Friday, so tune in for our Week in Review. I'm Tiziana Deering.